from the intersection of technology and public accounting.
It's technology advice and insight you can trust.
This is Tech2Go.
Tech2Go is the CPA Technology Advisor's monthly podcast program, a fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnist Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
Tech2Go is sponsored by our friends at ADP. Visit them at smallbusiness.adp.com/accountants. Hi, this is Greg LaFollette. We're recording episode 8 of Tech2Go. We have the whole crew here today. Everybody's alive and well. Randy, you're with us in an airport, I would guess, right?
That's correct.
Okay, well, safe travels. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to squeeze us in. We appreciate it. Dave McClure, you're with us also from the East Coast, right?
From the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia.
All right, in the opposite side of the country, three time zones away, Brent Goodfield and our good fellow in beautiful Portland, Oregon, right?
That's easy for you to say.
Yeah, right. I don't know where the field was coming from. I was trying to put you out in the field or something. Well, we've got a lot of things to cover today. I want to start, of course, by again thanking our sponsor ADP. These guys are investing some dollars to help us pay the bandwidth bills, and fortunately those bills are going up because there's more and more people joining us, so we sure appreciate those guys. Last week I was in Chicago and I did the walking tours for the Illinois Society, that the Chicago show, which is getting to be a really, really good show, huge show. And so I did the walking tours, and one of the stops turned out to be the ADP booth. And the guys spent almost all of their time talking about all of the tools that that ADP has for accountants on their website. And there was a bunch of things in there that, frankly, I didn't know were there, but there were a lot of people actually pretty impressed with what they saw. I had about 90 of my closest friends jammed around that booth, and which was kind of fun in itself. But I want to thank those guys. They stepped up here to help us out, and they've got good products and a bunch of free stuff, and that's always important to practicing accountants. So, interestingly enough, as we're talking about payroll, our first topic today happens to be payroll, and not that had anything to do with the fact that ADP was our sponsor, because we were going to do payroll anyway. And as a matter of fact, by the time we get done, they may not be our sponsor anymore. We'll have to wait and see. So let's talk a little bit about accountants and payroll. I know we've got a lot of differing opinions here, but before I kick this thing over, I'd like to give everybody a little bit of my perspective. Back in the late 70s, the accounting profession pretty well owned the payroll business. Things started getting more and more complex. You know, if you remember, we didn't have PCs, or we didn't have laser printers, we didn't have ACH, we didn't have lots of things. We also didn't have the complexity that we have in payroll and employment practices back then. And a lot of accountants did payroll. In fact, all accounting firms did payroll. It was just one of the services they did for their clients. And back about that time in the late 70s, the early 80s, things started getting a little more complex, and ADP stepped up and they sent people out to accounting offices all over the country, mine included. And they said, you're too smart and too valuable and too highly trained, and your time is worth more than doing payroll. If you were really, really smart, you'd give me your payroll clients. And this young woman that they sent in had, a short skirt and a $400 smile. And so I gladly gave her all of my payroll clients, and we got out of the payroll business. Fast forward 25 or 30 years, and what you end up is that that ADP is the largest payroll processor in the world, or in the, certainly in the country, you know, process something like 35% of all the W-2s or some crazy thing, and they do $6 or $8 billion worth of payroll, and the average accounting firm, 85% of the accounting firms have less than $500,000 in revenue. So, you know, and they're not doing that much payroll. But here, about 5, 6, 8, 10, maybe 10 years ago, as technology started changing, lots of accounting firms started getting back in the payroll business. A lot of movement back in the payroll business, and a lot of accountants have figured out that it's a real sticky product, and clients want you to do it, and it's not all that difficult with shared tools and things. And so there's been a huge movement, both with people, you know, buying products and all sorts of different things. And at the same time, the big guys, you know, ADP and Paychex and Ceridian and the rest have all come up with ways to partner with accountants in some fashion or another, and that wasn't always the case. They didn't really have much of a partnership. The partnership was give me your clients and see you later. But over the last 10 years, that's certainly changed. So where are we with the state of payroll in public accounting offices today? Randy, you're out there a lot. What do you see?
Well, Greg, I think you're right. A whole lot of firms have decided that that's a pretty good business to be back in and have really jumped in many cases with 2 feet. You've still got a number of the firms that are saying, you know, this is hands-off. We're just going to cross-refer it to one of the big publishers and be done with it. But I think your perspective here is actually, you know, pretty good in that you've got the high-end providers like the ADP and the Ceridians, and you've got several of the vendors who have taken a strategy that says, let's be accountant-friendly. You know, PayCycle and Thompson might be two that fit in that category. And then others have been, I'll call it in and out of the business, but there's actually a broad number of players that are there, probably 10 or more that all have what I would consider CPA firm-friendly approaches nowadays.
Right.
I think you're absolutely correct that the technology has made this a lot simpler, and I'm going to suggest that the automatic deposit, the ACH entries, the pay cards, and some of the things that are happening in that area are clearly making a big difference for the ease of performing a payroll, because you don't have to print the forms and get the forms distributed, and the delivery times and all those things are.
Randy, go back and explain those pay cards a little bit. I mean, this is huge. With almost, I've heard between 20 and 25% of employees are unbanked, which shocked me.
Yep.
But that really takes the direct deposit things out. So for people who employ lots and lots of, oh, like maybe young people in a McDonald's or something, occasional labor, this pay card thing is huge. How does that work?
Well, you know, it was even more odd to me, Greg, because I run a fairly upscale business with my NMGI operation, and I discovered when I wanted to go to completely automated payrolls, I had people that didn't have bank accounts in my staff, and I was just appalled that such a thing could happen. But for us to be able to do a completely ACH-driven automated clearinghouse, an electronic deposit, if you will, that you could actually get the equivalent of a debit card where you could actually drop off the money that you were paying the employee and they could immediately pull it out with no charge, in effect, from many of the banks, like an ATM transaction. So, in effect, they had access to their cash wherever there were ATM machines. So it was like almost doing a cash payroll directly into these systems. And
they could also use it just as a regular, like a debit card, right?
That's exactly right. So most of them function like a debit card. So literally what you're doing is you're loading up their debit card, and what they discover is they now have more financial control over their records than they've ever had before. There are still some that take everything out because they don't want the audit trails, I suspect. Or maybe they just don't understand how to use the system. But most right away get this idea that we can go to places that accept debit cards. Really, almost any place that swipes a credit card nowadays will accept a debit card as well, or any place there's an ATM, and get cash. So now instead of carrying around large amounts of cash, we now have our cash
know, this concept and this technology was rolled out, I'm going to say, 4 years ago, by Intercept ETF up in Fargo, and they kind of pioneered it along with a couple of the banks. And within just a couple of years, it's now a second nature. I mean, I think every single player has a way to handle it, because from the payroll software side, it's just another bank account, right?
That's correct, and that really has made a huge difference, because now, again, we can do everything electronically, and that really, from a CPA firm perspective, eliminates a lot of the pain of the deadline of delivery of documents for distribution.
Right. I had one of my favorite conversations in this payroll world was actually quite a few years ago now, but and I was practicing full time, and a friend of mine called. This friend happens to practice in Long Island, has an office in Manhattan too, and he called and talked to me about doing direct deposit payroll, because he knew I was doing that, and he asked how we were doing it, and I described what a pain it was, because at that time you had to go to all the different banks and make all these deals, and I said to him, first of all you have to get with the bank and figure out what their requirements are. And he said, well, I went to my bank and they said they don't do electronic banking. And I said, really, who's your bank? And he said, Citibank. And of course I had a big laugh, because Citibank's got 3,000 people here in Sioux Falls in the credit card division, and they obviously do electronic banking and moving money around, but he just hadn't got to the right person. And for many years, that was a huge problem. And then this company up in North Dakota, this Intercept, came out, and they now they stand between accounting payroll software, and that's almost anybody's software, and the banks, and they make all this stuff happen for firms that don't want to have the hassle of dealing with multiple banks. You know anything about how firms are implementing it? Are they sticking with whatever comes out of their payroll software, or are they using companies like Intercept? And there are a couple of other companies too that does that. National Direct Payments does it, and a couple of others. Do you see firms using stuff like that, Randy?
I do, and it really does depend on their volume to a degree, and whether or not they're trying to keep the detail transactions so they can do more costing, things like that. You know, in some cases, the payroll entries can just be summarized and posted, so it's really not a big deal.
Right.
But if, in fact, they want the detail, yes, they're using these type of products to get her done.
Right. Now, Thompson, the old Thompson's got what used to be Payroll Solutions is now, the Creative Solutions product is now Payroll CS. And they've established a couple of other deals. Randy, you know anything about what they're doing?
Well, yes. In fact, they're really headed towards, a service bureau type of operation.
Right. They're building a big thing to do their, because they're in the service bureau business now, and they figured out how hard it was, so now they're building something to do it better for themselves, and then they're going to sell it to other people, right?
Yeah, and the last I knew, Greg, that, Thompson was actually handling 6 or 7 million, payroll checks, if you will, over a typical pay period.
Yep.
Throughout their software. So, they were a very quiet, dominant, I'll call it private label branded, if you will, because so many of the CPA firms were actually doing the work. So, as you've watched the evolution over the last 4 or 5 years, the ability to have customer or payroll employee portals functioning, and the ability to do time capture at the front lines and transfer it back in, all those tools have become so much more automated through the Internet enablement. And let's face it, a lot of their products in CBS Payroll and so forth did that well early on.
Right.
But they've had a lot of the building blocks in place for a long time.
Sure. Well, and obviously now Intuit sold some of their high-end software just about a little over a year ago to Sage, right? And now they rolled out online payroll just last week.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty fascinating because, obviously they're giving away the first 1,000 people who sign up a free year's worth of payroll, kind of an interesting promotional deal.
which happened exactly the same time that that PayCycle announced free payroll for accounting firms.
Exactly.
Wow, what an interesting coincidence that was.
Yeah, so you know, obviously those people are in the same neck of the woods, so you wonder if something might have leaked out between them, but regardless of that, it's really made this online payroll quite accessible. And frankly, when you look at not only the ones we've talked about so far, but others like Sage and others that have been in this business for a long time, these systems are pretty elegant, pretty simple to use, and frankly will do many of the very complex transactions. And from a CPA firm perspective, it sure feels like to me this is one more service to hold your client closer. And as you mentioned earlier, it is a sticky service. If you've got payroll, it's much harder for a firm to go looking elsewhere for other services. So, you know, the old banking rule of thumb, three services and you're stuck. Well, you know, if you've got payroll and audit and tax, you've pretty well got them stuck.
Exactly. Now, Dave, I know you've got a contrarian view here. I know people will be shocked that you have a contrarian view.
Yes, I'm sure they will. I have to, truth in advertising, admit that Greg and I have been sort of feuding by email on this subject, and I got up this morning to a Monday morning email from Greg thunderously saying, "Dave, you just don't get it." And you may be right. You may be right. Here's
That's all right.
Quandary.
I don't get it on network neutrality. So.
Here's my issue. You're right. It's getting simpler every day. And the simpler it gets, the more and more corporate managers, especially, I think, in the mid-range to small business, are going to look and say, why should we pay someone else to do this when we can do it with one of our own clerks? I think that what's happening here and the fact that they're giving away free payroll for a year just fits right into this. I think we're about to see a wave of consolidation in payroll software, because right now there's, what, a dozen vendors or more, plus onlines, plus service bureaus. I think we're looking at consolidation coming. These guys want to shore up their relationships before the consolidation hits. And I think ultimately, while it's a wonderful service today, I think you have to look down the road and wonder how long it's going to stay that way, because there's nothing to payroll that you can't do yourself. And what used to make it painful, I mean really painful for business managers, is your payroll tied you to the office. You couldn't go out of town because you had to sign the payroll checks. That's just not true anymore. So I think obviously it's a very lucrative business. It's a high-intensity service business for accountants, but it's not a foundation I'd build the firm on.
I guess I would agree that it's not a foundational thing. But I know that all the studies, all the empirical data that I have, shows that accountants who are in that business, when they talk to their clients want them to do their payroll. And when they say, do I want my payroll done by my accountant that I see every day, that I know and trust and love, or do I want it done by a large corporation that may have, and here I go down the let's blast, ADP, which is a little bit like, I suppose, biting the hand that's feeding me as we talk. But, do you want your payroll done by a large corporation that may have a really, really great reputation and a good product, or do you want it done by somebody that you know and love and trust? Brent, do you guys do any payroll?
We do. We kind of went full circle. So, we were doing payrolls, then we decided we weren't going to do them anymore, gave them all away to the ADPs of the world, the Paychecks, that kind of thing. And now we've come back. And I think the reason is because of what you just said. Clients appreciate the relationship that they have with their CPAs, and that expands to payroll. And it's not a matter of cost. It's a matter of trust. And I think that's why the firms that are doing payroll for their clients, it's kind of a win-win, because the client gets the trusted advisor relationship that expands to payroll, and the accountant has the payroll information handy that they can incorporate in the year-end compliance work and the financial statement work.
Sure. Now, just to to kind of follow on what Dave said in terms of consolidation, I thought it was interesting that when Microsoft launched their Microsoft Office accounting product, a couple of years ago now, they specifically went out and partnered with ADP, and they've got that special ADP product kind of baked into Office accounting. It's not the traditional ADP product, but it's powered by ADP. It's kind of a partnership thing. Lots of different ways to slice and dice that. I don't know. I mean, I haven't talked to any specific business using that process, through Microsoft Accounting and on into ADP, but I've looked at it and it's pretty slick. Anybody else looked at that?
I have, and I actually know of some people that are using it with good success. So again, that was a fairly sophisticated product in concept, but I think the right way to think about it is just using the calculation engines and has some simplified interfaces and uploads, downloads the data. Well, it's a nice little interface.
Right. Well,
I was just going to say ADP, hats off to those guys because they see that, as the payroll is going more to non-third-party vendors, which is what they are, then they're using their tools and their expertise to make those available to the various services that are maybe taking their business away, so to speak.
Well, I guess in summary, I will again point out to everybody now, Randy, you talked about Intuit's free payroll, and that's it's free payroll for a year. I think it's through all of 2008, right?
Mm-hmm.
For any accounting firm, right?
That's correct.
And
basically, they did have a limitation posted. It was the first 1,000 users or whatever.
Right.
So we'll have to see how that comes out.
Yeah. My guess is if they're lucky enough to attract 1,000 users, they'll be the happiest people in town, and they'll expand that just as fast as they can.
Mm-hmm.
But PayCycle, interestingly enough, announced exactly the same thing. So if you are running an accounting firm and you're suffering with your payroll or doing it somewhere, just want to try out those services, they actually look a lot alike because it's web-based and it's PayCycle coined that DIY, do it with you process where you can kind of carve off as much as you want to do and move the rest of it up, and it's pretty slick concept. If you want to eat your own dog food, give it a try. It doesn't cost anything, and I think you might discover that you might like to be in that payroll business. And
yeah, in fact, I've reviewed PayCycle at great depths. In fact, most of the products that we're talking about, but I've spent enough time with that product. The key limitation is 50 users in the payroll, and what they're trying to do is match the capabilities of their products to the type of payrolls that they'll perform.
Right.
But
that's not a technical limitation. That's a marketing limitation.
They
stick to it really hard.
That's right. But fundamentally, the product's quite gorgeous to use. And when you look at some of these new approaches that have been advanced by different competitors, and the updates that some of the long-term competitors have done, payroll is quite different in 2007 than it was in 2004.
That's exactly. It's very, very different.
Very different. It's appalling it could be that different. So if you've been complacent and not really reviewed it, thinking it's the same old story, well, you're probably not correct in your assumption.
Yep. And now is a great chance to go get it to go get it free. So what a great deal. Let's switch gears here. We probably beat payroll about to death. During this last month, we had an IPO that I wasn't smart enough to be involved in, but if you were involved in the VMware IPO, you're probably happy. Talk to me a little bit about VMware, Brent, and let's talk a little bit more about that whole virtualization thing. What happened with that?
Well, the IPO you're talking about is obviously the VMware IPO that went public, I believe, about the 15th of this month. It seems like just a side note here, I hope my money manager was smart enough to get in on some of this. But
you get home.
That's a different money manager, right? I think the stock opened about in the mid to high 50s. I just checked today, and it's in the low 70s. So it's had had some nice appreciation over the time, the short time that it's been on the market. And you know, I think with since the IPO, the VMware company itself is valued at the estimate is around $20 billion, which is with a B. That's a lot of capital to do some R&D in a technology, an industry, if you will, that is really hot right now. And VMware has been the leader and probably will continue to be over the short term. They've got some competitors. Microsoft has a virtual product, as we all know. ZenSource is another competitor, and they just recently announced their version 4, which you know, supports 64-bit operating systems and some other things. So there's some competitors out there, but there's no question that VMware is the leader in the virtualization area right now.
So over on the server side, I mean, VMware is really got the market share there, and a lot of people using it on the server side. But now with Vista machines out there, we talked about this a couple of months ago, and several people send notes back and say, wait a minute, you guys went through this this virtualization really fast for a guy like me. So I got a Vista machine, and I've gone to Microsoft's website, this question says, and I've downloaded Virtual PC, and I run it on my Vista, and it comes up, and now I've got this. What do I do? How do I do this whole thing? I'm running Vista on my desktop, and I want to run XP on that same machine. How do I do that?
Okay. Well, probably what they ended up with after installing Virtual PC 2007 is what's called the Virtual PC console. And in that little console, what you have to do is set up a virtual machine. So you've got some buttons on the right of this console. One is new, for example, and if you click on new, it opens a wizard that walks you through the creation of a new virtual machine. And part of that is you specify the operating system that you're going to use. You specify where this virtual machine hard drive is going to be located, and you can put that on a out on a network location, or you can put it locally. Now, if you put it out on a network location, maybe it's going to get backed up more frequently than it would be if it's stored locally, but the performance is probably going to suffer over local a local location for that virtual hard drive.
Sure. Could they put that just on a local USB drive?
They could put it on a local USB drive, but once again, you know, you're limited to the performance of USB 2 in this case, which is not going to be as fast as on the local bus of the machine, more than likely. So you have all those options. It's probably a better option to put the virtual hard drive on the local machine and then just back it up. Copy it out to the network or to a USB hard drive, so you have a copy of that hard drive if something happens to the one that's running on your local machine.
Okay.
Once that's set up, then it's a matter of just selecting that virtual machine, and there's a button again in the Virtual PC console. There's a start button, and you click on that start button. Now, initially, you're not going to have any operating system installed on this virtual machine, so you've got the hard drive carved out and you've got it set up, but you still have to go through and install an operating system. So you want to make sure that the XP media is in the optical drive on the host machine. Click the start button, and it's going to go out and it's going to find that media that's in the optical drive, and it's going to start installing XP in this virtual window, so to speak. And so you're going to walk through. You're going to walk through the installation of this XP machine as if it were a separate piece of hardware.
Oh, okay.
Once the XP machine is installed, then you're going to have to, the software is installed in the virtual machine, you're going to have to go through all the same steps that you would if you used a separate piece of hardware. So you're going to have to perhaps join this machine to your domain if you're in a domain environment. You're going to have to install applications to this virtual XP machine. Once all that's done, that's a good time to back up that virtual hard drive to your USB or network location so that if something happens, you can copy that drive back and be back to that point in time, so to speak, that snapshot when you made the backup.
Interesting way to do things. So at that point, now I know some people on the far out end of this actually use that in kind of a sandbox thing. I'll go over there and try new applications, and if I get in trouble, I can just blow it away and grab that machine back from my network drive and just set it up again. No fuss, no muss, right?
Yeah, it's actually a great technique. As long as you have a backup copy, then you can really test it hard. You can destroy it even if you want to. Find out what the issues are with an application you're installing, or perhaps an upgrade that you're doing. And if you get unintended results, then you just delete that drive that has the bad karma on it, if you want to think of it that way, and start over with the backup.
Okay, so how are small and medium-sized accounting firms using virtualization today? And are we now to the point where I'm going to call this hobby technologist accountants can actually do things, or do they still get themselves in trouble?
Well, obviously they can still get themselves in trouble, but the whole idea of virtualization is if you get yourself in trouble on a virtual machine, it's virtual trouble, but there's a pretty easy step back, if you will, as long as you've made those backups. And it's much different than a physical piece of hardware where you've really got to reinstall. There's not much of a step back option with a machine that experiences a problem.
So, Randy, I know you've been talking about virtualization for a long time. What's your advice to firms?
Well, as I was listening through the process here, I think everything we've said is pretty much online. What I'm suggesting is that right now they pick key applications that they're going to have for an extended period of time. And I'm going to pick on 2005 tax as an example. And that they actually build a virtual machine. The technique that was described is perfectly usable. So you'd install your XP, you might install Office, and then I usually recommend they make a copy of that base machine and then go ahead and install the tax software and actually try to run an application inside the virtual machine. So we're seeing both products, Microsoft's virtual PC being used, as well as the VMware workstation product. And it's probably helpful for the listeners to know that, they can try the virtual PC 2007, as we suggested before, for free, but they can buy the workstation, the VMware workstation product, for less than $200, and it has the utility to actually point to virtual PC 2007 virtual machines and convert them to VMware virtual machines. So they don't even have to rebuild the virtual machine. They can convert one virtual technology, Microsoft's, to the competitor's VMware's.
So you could start in the free world, and if you got really into this and started moving down the line, and what I would call it like step up to generally accepted best of breed, you've not lost everything. You can convert.
That's correct. And what you gain is you gain a little more performance. You gain much smaller VMs to do exactly the same things. The disks, this virtual disk can be actually smaller. In other words, the disk allocation. And, just in general, there's more features. Some USB pass-throughs and other things where VMware is just a little more mature than the technology that Microsoft has purchased, updated, and is distributing. The other thing when you ask about just day-to-day firms, I'm picturing a firm right now, a little larger than the average, a 35-person firm, but they're 100% VMware at this point. They have no other technologies. So all of their servers, everything, Citrix, Exchange, everything is virtualized. And what they've discovered is they're buying less quantity of servers. The ones they have certainly are powerful, but they're not as big as I normally would recommend, and that they're far more reliable than the traditional again, trying to picture all of the servers in a CPA firm can be virtualized, and now when we get that tax update in the middle of tax season, we copy the virtual machine over and install the new software in a separate virtual machine to prove to ourselves that it works.
Sure. Now, you know, a couple of last month we talked about Exchange 07, Brent, and you talked about one of the best practices being actually to separate several of those several of the components onto different servers. So now we're talking about taking one server, virtualizing it into multiple servers, and where does that get us regarding something like Exchange 07? We have one box, we tell it it's multiple boxes, and then split up Exchange?
Yeah, you absolutely can, because again, the software, you know, doesn't know whether it's running in a virtual environment or if it's running on the hardware itself. So you've got a single piece of hardware that becomes the host for several virtual servers, and Exchange doesn't know the difference. So that's you could literally have all of those Exchange role servers running on the same physical hardware. Now that may not be the most advantageous way to do it, but
sure.
But you can certainly do it. And the thing that we should add to Randy's comments here is that there is a free product from VMware. The VMware server product is a free download, and you can certainly use that to run XP. Now you may not want to long term, but if you just want to evaluate VMware, and there's evaluation versions of all of their products, including Workstation, but their server product is a free download, and they may have done that to compete with Microsoft, who makes their virtualization products available without charge.
Sure. And you know, the other side of that, Greg, and this is where I see the long term benefit of this for whole virtualization, is for a decade plus, the conventional wisdom has been you want to minimize how many things you run on a single server. So we separated our file server and our Exchange server and our SQL server and so forth, and that's technically still a pretty good strategy. So when you have an engagement manager, it's on a separate server, and your paperless is on a separate server. Well, if you're a small firm and you're looking at four or five servers, all of a sudden, technically, you're pretty darn safe to run two servers, because you can, in effect, virtualize those, and if one server would fail, you can run all five of your server functions, let's say, on a single box. Most servers today will run the equivalent of 10 to 15 servers if they're configured correctly. So instead of us having a server farm of three or more servers, with virtualization, I see many firms being able to run two, or maybe for safety purposes, three. But I see very few CPA firms that can justify having more than three servers if they virtualize. And to me, that's going to be a huge cost savings from a server perspective, because we might avoid buying $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 machines.
Sure. So, I mean, it's interesting. You know, when Mr. Gates talked years and years and years ago about any service, anywhere, any time. And I don't know if this is what he was talking about, but more and more things happen like virtualization that allow, that really divorce the software from the hardware, when before it was so tightly tied together. We did this with Citrix and put those thin clients out on the other end and all the smarts back at the home office or at the mothership. And then Microsoft went out and bought this product called Softricity. And I know this is different, and I don't want to confuse people because this is completely different from virtualization. So we're kind of switching topics, but we're not switching the conceptual part as much as one might think. Is that kind of how you see the Softricity thing, Randy?
Well, I'd say that's true, and I'm trying to figure out how to explain in words what's going on, because the concept of getting virtualization right and getting what's going on with Microsoft's application virtualization in Softricity is tougher. It could maybe somebody else on the call picked that up, and let me think for a minute more. Because normally, as you know, Greg, I just kind of respond and say, well, here's where this stuff is at.
Sure.
But, you know, Microsoft has had the Softricity stuff since mid-year last year. I think
right.
It got in July of 2006. But, you know, this is much more about application deployment, I think, is the best way to think it, about it, as opposed to, you know, actually the way the applications run.
Yeah. So, well, Brent, I mean, you and I have talked about this before. Do a quick compare and contrast. If I want to run, you know, last year's tax product, and I'm sitting here in my office, and there's a couple of ways I can get it. I mean, other than having it installed on my network, I can use the Citrix method, or I can use the Softricity method. So if I use the Citrix method, I connect to a Citrix server, and I send clicks and keystrokes across the wire. And the program is running out there at the server and sending me screenshots back. Is that right?
No, that's not right.
Okay, explain that to me then.
The way Softricity works.
Oh no, I was describing Citrix.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes.
So that's how Citrix works.
That's
now
right.
Softricity is different. How?
Well, the Softricity product is actually called SoftGrid. And the way it works is there's a soft grid server, if you will. And on this server, there are a number of what are called sequencers. So each sequencer holds the DLLs, the INIs, the files, the application-specific settings for a particular application, and pick virtually any application you want.
Okay.
So you've got these sequencers that are holding all these application-specific settings on the system. When a client connects to that server, assuming that client has access to that particular application, the sequencer sends little pieces of the application over to the client, and they're actually run locally. And they're run locally in a sandbox. You mentioned the word sandbox, so it's completely independent of the local operating system, but it runs as if you had installed the application right on that local box.
Right, so all the heavy lifting is now done on my machine, just as though I had taken the distribution disks for that tax package and installed it on my machine. It would make changes to the registry and would load up a bunch of DLLs and all of that stuff, right?
Yep,
in this case,
exactly.
That all comes from the network. And when I close the program, all that evidence of that program being installed, or because it really wasn't installed, but all the evidence is gone, right? It's
well,
like I never ran it.
Virtually all of it's gone. The local machine actually caches some of that connection information so that the next time you run that application, it loads a little bit quicker. But all those DLLs and those INIs and the files, all those kinds of changes, all that stuff resides on the SoftGrid server in this sequencer box, if you want to think of it that way.
Okay. Well, it's certainly a changing world in how that stuff is delivered. I mean, I'm kind of looking and saying, you know, right now there's a lot of people who are delivering product services to accounting firms in a Citrix process, and they're just shoving it over the web from a Citrix farm. But eventually they'll start looking at things like Softricity that would be much more elegant, wouldn't it?
Well, it certainly has the promise of that. The nice thing about the SoftGrid, the Softricity product, is that because now that Microsoft owns it, you know, it interacts with Active Directory, so you can set permissions by users and groups on who can access a particular application. A network administrator has a lot more control over how that application gets used than they did before.
Okay. Well, that gives us a lot to think about. Dave, that make your head hurt?
Not too much, Craig. I've just been following along, and the only thing that runs through my mind in all of this is just the standard. I understand the virtualization engines are very stable at this point. They're marvelous technology, but I'm compelled to throw in my two cents worth. Backup, backup, backup. Whenever you're installing new stuff on a new server, make sure the old stuff is kept somewhere, and whatever you create in the virtualized area, if it has any relevance to your business model, make sure you save a copy before you delete that the virtual engine.
Good point, and I'm glad you threw that in, Dave, because that's actually going to be one of our topics for our next Tech to Go, and we're gonna talk about backup, local backup, network backup, internet backup, all of these different services, all of that stuff that's going on. So if any of you out there listening have thoughts on that, send us a note. And by the way, we are recording today and into the future. We're recording with TalkShoe Live. And if you would like to join us, simply go to TalkShoe and establish an account so you can dial in. Very, very simple. You just pick up the phone and dial in, or you can listen to us live on your computer. But we're going to record episode 9 for October. We're going to record on Monday, September 17th at 2:30 Central Daylight Time. So that'd be 1:30 Dave, your time, and 12:30 your time, Brand, out in the West Coast. So Monday, September 13th, and if you want to join us, just dial in through TalkShoe. You'll have to establish an account, and if you're here and I see you online, if you've got a question, you can let us know that you've got a question. Kind of raise your hand electronically, and we'll just include you in the process. I have invited a special guest to that recording session, and we're going to talk about a couple of really new things that are pretty exciting. The what I'm calling scan and organize software, and scan and populate software. So these are really, really hot. I know, Randy, you're talking about these and getting asked about them all the time, right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm headed to Texas to talk about them tomorrow.
Okay, well, there's lots of stuff going on, and I did invite Dave Weil, who's the founder of SurePrep and the builder of the first scan and populate product. And the scan and populate products kind of sit on top of the scan and organize. So all of the scan and populate products include scan and organize, but the vice versa is not true. Is that how you understand it, Randy?
Yeah, that is absolutely correct.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to talk about those. Again, it's Monday, September 17th, 2:30 Central on TalkShoe. So if you want to join us, pop over, and we'll bring Dave into that conversation for just a little while as we talk about that. And we're going to talk about backup. And today, I want to talk just a little bit at the we've got some time left, Dave, to talk about something that I know you have a passion for, this whole idea of telemedicine. They probably couldn't call it iMedicine because Steve Jobs would sue him, right?
Yeah, exactly. But they are calling it now the umbrella term they're using for all of it now. Telemedicine, telehealth, and all of that is e-health, which
okay.
is a term that sort of came out of Europe as an umbrella to cover not only clinical applications like monitoring of health patients, but also the administrative practices. Just this week, finally, Alaska became the 50th state to now adopt a system so that doctors no longer have to write prescriptions by hand, which is a marvelous step forward. I think there's a lot of potential for e-health in this country.
So how can, I mean, we're the you got doctors and clinics and hospitals moving to EHR, that electronic health records, very, very quickly. And, I know accounting firms that are actually involved in helping in that. Where are opportunities for accountants to get involved? How can they help their clients? How can they make a buck while they're doing it? What do you see?
Well, first of all, let's examine the fact that the healthcare industry is one in crisis right now. It is the largest component of employee benefits for many companies. It is a major component of their overall cost structure, and it's dreadfully inefficient. We've simply built a system that doesn't adopt a lot of the electronic technologies, and much of it has to do with the fact that over the last couple of decades, there are new pressures now for healthcare professionals and for health service providers and for the administrative overseers to make a profit, to do it and do it now in this quarter. So what you see is a situation analogous, I think, to what happened when personal computers first came on the scene. They were expensive. They required an investment. They required a vision. And often companies simply didn't get the vision. They said, well, yeah, they can save us money down the road, but what good are they today? It took accounting professionals to bring computers into the business environment and to prove their value. I think it's going to take the accounting industry to save the health industry in the United States, and from there extended to much of the rest of the world. I think what we really need are for accountants to sharpen their pencils and sit down and go back to their clients and show them exactly how much money there is to be saved if they're applying technologies. The problem, Greg, as you know, is that technologists, including me, tend to be very short-tempered and very impatient with the fact that our clients don't always adopt the technology as fast as we want them to, and we lose interest and we walk away. We simply say, oh, you guys don't get it, and so therefore we're not going to spend our time trying to help you out of this anymore. This one's too important to the economy, too important to all of our accounting clients. I think accountants need to take a lead role in bringing e-health services, both clinical and administrative, and making health more affordable for everyone.
You know, Dave, it seems to me that, you know, there was only a year or so difference in legislation between HIPAA and SOX. And HIPAA, I mean, I see a lot of these medical things that could be advancements. People just shut down right away because they say it's, well, we can't do that. It's not HIPAA, quote, compliant, which is nonsense. But it's been a real stumbling block for the medical profession, while SOX has been, well, I mean, basically it's been a gold rush for our profession. How do you see, is there any relationship between those two?
Well, I think HIPAA, in retrospect, is going to turn out to be a disaster simply because we've got two goals we're trying to achieve. One is to make your medical information as universally available as we can, while at the same time protecting it from everyone we don't want to see it. When it comes to procedures and safeguarding data, I don't know of anyone who's better at it than an accountant, because we live with it every day. We deal with it every day. So I think, honestly, I do see a lot of parallels. I think that many accountants look at the healthcare industry and think, unless they directly have healthcare clients, they think that it doesn't affect them and it doesn't affect their clients, and they're wrong.
Yep. Well, I know if I could get all of my health records on a little RFID chip and get it injected in my arm or something, I'd do it in a heartbeat.
I would too.
You know, so people could figure out exactly what was happening. You know, they said, boy, that bus just hit that old fat guy. You know, wonder what kind of medical problems he's got.
Well, and it's interesting because while we are going to electronic records for health at a very rapid pace, I still walk into my doctor's office, and the first thing I see are those massive racks of handwritten, paper-bound medical records. They still exist. They're still the heart of the industry, and it's crippling the healthcare industry. I have to believe that.
Sure, sure. Well, I agree, and I know that you've been a real champion in that, and just keep pushing that rock up the hill, and we promise not to call you Sisyphus, right?
Okay. Well, as long as accountants understand They're the ones who can lead the charge in this,
sure,
just as they did 30 years ago with computers, and with every bit as marvelous a result.
Just if nothing else, we lead by example.
Yes, sir.
Well, guys, we're perilously close to our hour. Randy, Brent, anything that we missed that we should be talking about today? Any news? Anything exciting?
Well, you know, before switching to exciting, I might just pick up on the healthcare piece.
Oh, great.
Because I really do, from an EHR perspective, the healthcare record side, as well as the payment cycle, particularly with the new healthcare savings accounts and so forth, there are procedures that the accountants can truly help with. So, you know, I would have to kind of echo the thoughts here that CPAs can make a huge difference, particularly those firms that have a healthcare focus. Believe that from the statistics, and I'm going to go speak for the Healthcare Billing Management Association group next week, so I've done preparation for them, that somewhere around 40% of the billing systems will get replaced in the next 7 years by 2014 to accommodate some of the new healthcare records and payment needs. And there is actually a difference in payment right now to the physician if they don't comply with recommending necessary procedures at the time of encounter. So you make an appointment, you're instructed while you're making the appointment, oh, we see you need this procedure. If the physician fails to do that, they actually get compensated less, and that compensation is enough less that they can handily pay for most of the automation that it takes to get themselves converted.
Well, that's certainly a way to get everybody's attention. So that's a really good point.
So there's lots of other things that are going on that. In terms of, you know, technology's kind of picking up on that, probably the key thing to watch, and we'll be prepared to talk more about it next time, is the next generation of hardware that we discussed earlier in the year is starting to arrive.
Sure.
And I have loaded up my new generation box, which I received here while being out on vacation. So we'll want to talk about that. And in your purchases for the fall, you'll want to make sure that you're looking to the new generation of technology.
Okay. Well, we've got our three topics for next month, for October Tech to Go. That will be episode 9. We're going to talk about backup. We're going to talk about new hardware. So I know Brent will be all excited about to talk about hardware, right, Brent?
Absolutely.
Okay, and Dave's got a true passion in this backup world. So we're going to talk about that. And I think the scan and organize and scan and populate is going to be the biggest thing to hit public accounting since paper. It's going to be huge in how that works. So again, write that date down, Monday, September 17th, 2:30 Central. We'll record Tech to Go episode 9. A big thank you again to our friends at ADP for the bandwidth payments, and we appreciate them. Thanks to all of you who are listening. As I told you guys last month, the listenership is shooting up like a hockey stick, and I'll remember to send you out some of the stats on it. But it's pretty exciting. It's pretty fun. Last comments, anything, Brent?
Well, this is something for the future, but there's lots of changes happening in telephone communications. Microsoft has a small business telephone system that they're touting quite heavily, and they just recently purchased a voice recognition company that's going to integrate into that. It's called ResponsePoint. Might be something interesting for a future episode.
Okay. Well, we've got telephony for accountants on the list, so that'll be fun. Brent, thanks for your time today. As always, enjoyed having you. David, thank you particularly for your contrarian view. That always makes things interesting.
Indeed it does, Greg.
Okay. So I enjoyed spending some time with you. Thanks very much. Randy, you're about to leave us to go jump on an airplane, I assume.
That's exactly correct. So I hope there was not much noise background problems from here, and we look forward to talking to all of you next time.
Certainly not the most crystal clear connection we've ever had, but amazingly good for an airline club. Who are you flying today?
Today it's American.
Well, I hope your American flight gets you to exactly where you deserve to get to today.
I appreciate that, but you'd probably, as fun fact to know, flown every week this year and have yet to have a week with at least an hour delay.
Well,
so we've got a perfect record, and I'm hoping this week is the exception.
Yeah, I just passed 75,000 miles myself, and on my way to 120 or something, and it's part of the world. If I only get delayed an hour, that's the same as on time for me. Thanks, guys. We are at 1:37, so episode 8 of Tech to Go is completed, and we'll see you all next month. Be sure to join us on the 17th of September. Thank you again, guys. Bye.
That wraps up this edition of Tech to Go. Join the team around the table again next month for more technology advice and insight you can trust.
Tech to Go has been brought to you by the CPA Technology Advisor. Visit cpatechadvisor.com for more great podcast programs from the intersection of technology and public accounting.